It goes back to the concept that there are these windows of opportunity, especially in the development of the immune system, that in a way, even if something did not happen when the window was open, there are animals that is showing that you also may not be able to restore it later.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. We're a non-profit scientific organization advancing science in probiotics, prebiotics, and related fields. This episode is part of a series exploring early life microbiota development. We'll be speaking with experts about characteristics of the developing microbiota in early life, from infancy through childhood, and the relationship to children's health and development.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new episode of this series of podcasts from ISAP called Science, Microbes, and Health. And our guest, I'm really honored to have Professor Anne Salonen. Please let me introduce her. Professor Salonen is a principal investigator and director of the Human Microbiome Research Program at the Medical Faculty of the University of Helsinki in Finland. Her research is focused on the intestinal microbiota and in health and disease, especially in early life and in relation to diet. Dr. Salonen is a PI of the Finnish Health and Early Life Microbiota HELMI birth cohort and involved in maternal fecal microbiota transplantation studies to try to correct C-section dysbiosis. Dr. Salonen's research also entails female reproductive tract microbiota in relation to reproductive outcome. And I'm very, very pleased to have you here. Thanks for coming.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It's my pleasure.
You know, I'm used to give a lot of talks to the community, and when I want to catch people's attention about microbiota, I put a title of Nature that you were involved, that is called Poop Milk. You know what I'm talking, but we will discuss that later because I think it's an amazing job and I'm so happy to have you here. But first, let us know, how did you get involved in studying infant gut microbiome?
Yes, it dates back, I think, maybe 15 years ago already. And near my great mentor, Professor Willem de Vos, who moved from Netherlands to Finland, that time we were studying some small, we were looking for basically for the interested on understanding the early life microbiota development. And we did collaborate with clinicians, for example, pediatricians involved in pediatric allergies who had collected some poo samples. The focus was more on the clinical side. And then quite soon we actually realized that, first of all, we need longitudinal data. We need to be able to have not only one or two sample here and there, but we need frequent microbiota sampling, and we need to understand the multitude of early exposures, but then of course also the kind of outcomes. And there were not that many choices, so we actually realized that maybe we have to roll our sleeves and collect such a cohort, and we started applying grants, and that's how it started.
Fantastic. And why do you think that early life microbiome is so popular now in any pediatrics or gastroenterology congress? You will see a section about early life. Why do you think it became so important?
Yes, it's really definitely not anything marginal, but it's kind of mainstream in the microbiota aspect in pediatrics. If we think about the human microbiome research from that perspective first, so I think it's in a way, whether or not a researcher is working themselves on the early life microbiota, I think there is a big consensus that most likely the effects, the host physiology and immunology are the largest in the early life when the whole basically when the child is developing and everything starts more or less from the scratch. So both I would say the most substantial and long-standing effects on human physiology, I think we agree that we see on early life. And then if we think more from the clinician's perspective, I think in a way it's the same story that it's more or less generally accepted that the early microbial development is nothing that happens in isolation, but it's basically an intrinsic part of the child's physiological development. So they want to understand if there is, in a way, understand it better, and when some kind of intervening is needed, what is the evidence and how to do it.
Fantastic. But let's start from the very, very, very beginning, and I would go to the moment of birth. When do you think the decolonization really start? Because there is a lot of polemics still if the uterus is sterile, when colonization. What's your perspective?
Yes, there is definitely still no definite consensus and quite strong opinions in the field. At least for now, with the current evidence, I believe that in healthy pregnancies, the colonization starts when the membranes are broken. So that can still be actually within a uterus. So if there is, in a way, there is a contact to the vagina and related microbes, but most typically, of course, when the baby has born. However, I may maybe mention that we are scratching our heads. We have some unpublished data where we do see also actually in C-section born infants, we see in meconium some clear vaginal bacteria, and we are wondering how do they get to the meconium. So maybe the case is not closed, but I mean, so as I said, there is quite strong evidence that many of the studies, or basically the existing studies that claim that an unborn fetus has been colonized, there is strong documentation that actually it is contamination. So at birth, I say
you,
today.
You would say. But do you think that before birth, during pregnancy, that maybe microbial metabolites can affect the fetus development?
Absolutely, yes. There is indeed strong evidence that the maternal microbiota can communicate with the fetus already and affect it already during pregnancy. But indeed, this happens on the level of metabolites, not things that can actually pass the placenta, and intact bacteria cannot. So it's a kind of molecular level signaling that definitely takes place already during pregnancy.
And from the many factors that affect the baby in this very, very special time, I would say prematurity, the type of birth, C-section of vaginal, breast milk, antibiotics. Are we able to say, okay, this is the main factor that we should take into account, or the contribution is a little bit of everything? Or can you say, okay, if you have to pay attention, is this breast milk or the type of antibiotics or a little bit of everything?
You mean for the establishment of
exactly
the,
yeah
and the
yeah.
early colonization? Yes. Yeah, we know from dozens and dozens of thousands of infant samples actually by now that the route of delivery, whether it's a C-section or vaginal birth, that is the largest factor affecting the microbiota composition for the first weeks and months of the infant. However, what we don't know, and there is still surprisingly little, but also scientific literature, is that, in a way, what are the immunological and even functional microbiota differences between the birth modes and the kind of we talk about in the field about C-section microbiota signature, which means that there is typically very scarce bacteroidetes in C-section born infants, typically also less bifidobacteria, and this then starts to resolve latest around 6 months when the solids are started, because then the community evolves driven by rich dietary substrates. Of course, also, yes, definitely, whether the child is breastfed or formula fed, that's what we see typically, is that in breastfed, exclusively breastfed infants, actually the microbiota maturates, maturation is slower. So maybe at some point there was an oversimplification that we might have, there might have been a connotation that fast microplasma maturation is good, but in the early months it's not. So the kind of, if in exclusively breastfed infants, the gut microbiota is rather simple because it's bifidobacteria dominated, and it actually maturates on a slower pace than formula fed. Those babies tend to have more these adult type Clostridia much earlier. So these are the, I would say, most pronounced effects. And then, of course, yeah, whether if there is a lot of antibiotic exposure in the beginning, that also contributes. So these, I would say that these compositional differences are really well documented and established, but there are really knowledge gaps that in the end of the day, how do these compositional microbiota differences actually contribute then to the disease risk and the, even on child physiology, because it's quite invasive sampling if we would like to get from young infants a lot of blood samples, etc. So in most studies, this has not been feasible, actually.
So from what you say, I understand that it's not only important the composition, which microbes are there, but also the timing. You mentioned like a delay colonization, but bifidobacteria. Why do you think timing is important, the moment in which the immune system is exposed to these microbes? When there is a delay colonization, we will have problems.
It goes back to the concept that there are these windows of opportunity, especially in the development of the immune system, that in a way, even if something did not happen when the window was open, there are animals that is showing that you also may not be able to restore it later. This means that, at least in theory, that also those early microbiota differences that are resolved in the matter of months, that exactly that's the current understanding, that does matter, that even though the difference is resolved, but because in this specific vulnerable window of opportunity, there were, for example, certain microbes missing, or it was the community was in a way the if we call the maturation, we compare it to the age of the microbiota, that does not match to the chronological age of the child, that there is a mismatch. So this is where the problems may happen.
And I think if you have, when C-section is combined with antibiotics, the delay can be more pronounced. And what's the role there of breast milk?
In most cases, unfortunately, yes. And sometimes it's actually in research, it's even difficult to disentangle these effects because, as you say, they typically correlate strongly. And in one of the papers we did for this, for our birth cohort, we did it for ourselves to understand to what all variables the C-section or the birth mode is affected, but we actually put the whole bunch of results to supplement. And what we saw was that there was maybe for neonatologists and obstetricians, this is all clear, but not for us microbiome scientists, that we were really surprised to see to how many both maternal and infant variables the mode of birth was related. Because as you said, indeed, yes, you see that the breastfeeding is typically starts later, duration is shorter, and then even on the maternal side for the risk factors, etc. It's a kind of a cluster of variables in many cases.
And when we start, you mentioned the importance of longitudinal studies, that only a picture is not enough. We need to see like a movie to understand. Can you comment us about the Finnish cohort you are following? What can you tell us?
Yes, so we took an effort in this Finnish Health and Early Life Microbiota cohort, a Helmi cohort, that we've really taken effort on sample the babies frequently, so that we have for the first 24 months we had altogether 9 samples.
Okay.
Even more frequent in the beginning, and then for the second year, altogether 3 samples. And with these approaches, if you have longitudinal sample, then one can take this trajectory approach, which exactly kind of takes an advantage of the, in a way, acknowledges that there might be some variations, first of all, in the exact age when even healthy infants, depending on the exposures and, for example, type of diet, how their microbiota evolves. So when we kind of basically see, so we look for the kind of curve, we even talk about there is this growth curve for the length and weight development, but maybe one day we have this growth curve for the gut microbiota as well. We can then identify differences on the dynamics, which I believe the field acknowledges that it's probably more informative than looking on these snapshots. But what it also will allow, you then actually, in a way, look also on those snapshots, which might be most informative. And for example, if we can say that at certain age, maybe it doesn't matter if you have a microbiota type A or B, it's still natural variation. And in another age, because then it shows that the trajectories really differ, maybe it's more profound difference also in terms of what would be the effect on child physiology.
And how long have you been following this cohort? How big is it? And for how long you expect to follow? Because we know it's very challenging to keep on sampling. What's the expectancy?
So this spring, actually, the first kids now turned 10 already.
Oh.
Yes. So we started to recruit a cohort in 2016. We recruited 1,055 families. Also, we've sampled not only mothers, but also the fathers, so that we've published some work and more to come to understand what is the role of the father, actually, on the vertical microbiota transmission. The cohort was born over 2 full years, so right now they are 10 to 8 years, and we've conducted 2 extensive follow-ups, so that first we followed them up for the 2 first years of life, and then we had really great study retention rate because we had well over 900 families who completed this whole 2 year.
That's amazing.
We were really happy about that. And then we had the second follow-up in their preschool age when they were 4 or 5. And I got funding for that right post-COVID. And there were still some regulations. And I think people who have worked with longitudinal cohorts know that there is always the study retention. The longer you follow, the more families you lose. So we got roughly half of the families back for the preschool age follow-up. We are really grateful for those who stayed. We are still busy with some existing data, but we definitely, I would like to, I'm trying to get funding to be able to organize a follow-up at least once more when they are somewhere in their early teenage.
Teenage, fantastic. And maybe with this amazing amount of data, you can give us an insight in relation to a very old question: what comes first, the egg of the chicken or the chicken? I mean this. In some cases, it was supposed that some changes in the microbiome will anticipate diabetes or obesity or allergies or autism spectrum disorder. Can you tell us something? What comes first, a change in the microbiome, a chronic disease, or they come together? What's your experience?
Yes, that's very important question in the whole human microbiome field. And indeed, with longitudinal data, you can address that with a bit more certainty than with other types of data. I think it probably really varies also with depending on the disease, because we know, especially if there is medication, and then you sample when the both diagnosis and medication is already there, then in a way, without preceding samples, you can't say if there were microbiota alterations preceding the development of the condition. I can maybe answer on general level that because there are still I mean, we have more those cases now on the second follow-up, because now we start to have celiac disease, even rheumatoid arthritis, which were not there at the two-year follow-up. Yeah. So this data is quite fresh, and we just basically we are right now looking at it. So in for any specific disease, I can't comment it right now, but I can refer to something we published for the let's say for early micropath aberrations versus disease risk, that we definitely saw, and this was our this Nature Communications paper about the so-called well-being microbial well-being index that we did on this Helmi cohort, that for example the whether the child had let's put it that way, that as we know from all epidemiology that we should talk about increased or decreased risks.
So at least, it's not,
because of course non important maybe to say, and hopefully everyone understands that, for example, let's say the child is born by C-section, never got breast milk, got a lot of antibiotics. Still, this is not any deterministic route to develop all kinds of diseases. This child can be perfectly healthy. We know that on population level, it increases the risk for intermediate diseases.
That's a very good message for mothers, maybe, that are listening to us. That sometimes they have to go through a C-section, they have to get antibiotics, they cannot get. So it's not. We should be very careful not to put a blame on them. So exactly. It's very important what you said. It's very important.
Yes, all these diseases are multifactorial, and in many cases there is no choice. Because you absolutely have to go safety first.
Exactly. Life comes first.
But we do know that if there was... So basically this, let's say this normotypic early microbiome with bifidobacterial dominance, also a lot of bacteroides, which is typical in breastfed, C-section born, vaginally born infants, this decreases if in the first months this type of micropathy was, it did decrease the risk of or the odds of child being diagnosed with allergic disease at 2 or 5 years of age. So in that case, there is indication that it is the preceding microbiome condition that then either decreases or increases the
risk. Very clear. And let's go with a topic that I'm really fascinated that this study that in the press it was called Poop Milk, that I want you to introduce to let us know how the idea came, how did you have to deal with the ethics committee, how did you communicate this to parents. So please, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Yes, we are grateful for the collaboration with the neonatologist Sture Andersson and Otto Helve at Helsinki University Hospital, who without whom this, of course, would not be possible. And they made sure that all the, also here, safety first, that it was very controlled, very extensive pathogen screening and very close follow-up of the infants. So the hypothesis and thing that we wanted to test is that we realized that only in intervention setting we can actually really prove that, in a way, what is the effect of maternal microbiota inoculum that happens naturally in vaginal birth. And we wanted to question that if we do it experimentally, can we also restore the C-section-born infant's microbiota. And right now, we are actually more looking at the infant side. I can't communicate about those results yet. But what we know for the microbiota, so the clinicians gave, right after the C-section birth, the first milk feeding, there was this screened own mother's small amount of poo added to the milk, and this was the poo milkshake that indeed media picked, given as a first meal, and then the infants, where the microbiota was again sampled very frequently. And we could see that not on the day one or two, it was the inoculum had not yet been in a way established, but already by the end of first week, these C-section born infants who received the maternal fecal transplant, their microbiota looked like they were vaginally born. And this single inoculum at birth kept their microbiota looking like a vaginally born infant's microbiota, basically until the solid started, when then also those C-section born infants who did not get the inoculum also started to converge. I mean, as I mentioned at the beginning, on the second half of the first year of life, the microbiomes, independent of the birth mode, do converge.
And if you compare with vaginal seeding that has been extensively studied, what would you say? Vaginal seeding, poo, transplantation, or a combination of them would be a choice in the future?
There are important question. There are two or three randomized controlled trials, one in New Zealand, one somewhere in Europe, and maybe anyway, two or three altogether published, which did test the efficacy of vaginal seeding in randomized settings. And none of these trials found an effect on infants' gut microbiota beyond a couple of two, 3 days. So the conclusion was that vaginal microbes are not effective on restoring the infant's gut microbiota. And in ecological terms, this is very sound, because as an ecosystem, the vaginal lactobacilli, they thrive in very different environment than the infant gut is. And I know there are a couple of studies, two, I think, one showing also a bit more like positive for the vaginal seeding, one showing partial, the first, very first one, small study showing partial restoration. And then there is this one study that showed that there were some beneficial neurological effects. Okay. On infants after vaginal microbiota seeding. So I would say, in that sense, considering all available literature, it's maybe somewhat still inconclusive, but it's kind of, it's very clear that the most of the biggest impact and the most microbes that do colonize infant gut definitely come from mother's gut, not from the vagina.
That's a good point. And I would stay talking with you for hours, but we are coming to the end of the podcast. But let me ask you a final question. Where do you see your research in the next 5-10 years? Where are you focusing? Or what can we expect from your research in the next years?
So we will understand better the role of key microbes and hopefully also the causal relationships between, on one hand, on early exposures and these key microbes that then appear to be either hopefully beneficial or maybe somehow posing the largest risk for longer term health. And I do think and believe there will be more standardized methods than the fecal microbiota transplantation, which is mainly in a way a research tool on a safe and reproducible way to restore and support the development of infants also when there are some challenges in the beginning. And one special thing as a final note I want to mention is that we are very excited now with the preschool age follow-up, where we do see some intriguing lasting effects of breastfeeding years back. So I'm sure we will understand how the breastfeeding history actually can have lasting effects on both on the microbiome and on the child for years later.
Fantastic. Where can we find more of your work? YouTube, Instagram, any web page that you want to let us know?
So at Helsinki University, we have, my lab has a webpage which is called Microbes Inside. So I would advise people to go there. There we also introduce the birth cohort and there is other information about ongoing projects and also other stuff than Early Life Microbiota that my team does.
Fantastic. I will go and take a look. And I have to say, to tell you goodbye and thank you a lot. It was an amazing conversation for me. I hope for the audience too. And thanks again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. If you've been enjoying the show, please follow and rate our podcast to help support our continued work. You can also send us your feedback, questions or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org and check the show notes for links and further information on this topic.